This is part 10 of the Ominous Parallels series based on the book, The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America, by Leonard Peikoff, as you can hear me thumbing through the book. We're probably four-fifths of the way through, maybe five-sixths. I'm going to finish up the 10th chapter, which was started in part 9. And probably do two more full chapters, and maybe a conclusion. I don't know, because maybe I should read, even if I don't agree with it. But Peikoff, you know, I think that, you know, presidents matter and all this other stuff, which is where I think, you know, most people's shortcoming is. But at any rate, this also kind of dovetails in with a series I'll start with Larry the Contractor Guy about Hitler and the Reich. Larry came by this because of certain information he came upon when he was growing up and stayed with, I guess, somewhat of an interest, maybe a fascination. I think that's the wrong word. I don't think he'd choose that, and rightly so. But it stayed with him, and he's researched a long time. And he's going to be starting something on February 14th. So here you have a look at Germany as it leaves the Weimar era and begins the era under Hitler. And then I look back also at the Lusitania series, in which I think the Germany that was trying to coexist with Britain, the country's philosophy was much different. And I don't think you ever really talk about a majority. I mean, it's the people who go out and make policies and how much they can get the people behind them, I think, that really are the ones who have hell to pay for what they've done. But obviously, the mentality in pre-World War I Germany was much different than it was prior to World War II. So, anyway, we'll pick it up here to finish off the 10th chapter, which is entitled The Culture of Hatred. The mind cannot know truth, said the new philosophy. The mind dare not know itself, said the new psychology. The mind cannot understand nature, said the new physics. The mind cannot reach God, said the new theology. The mind is unspiritual and unfeeling, said the new literature. The mind stifles self-expression, said the new education. The mind is banal, said the new art. The mind is dead, said the new culture. It cannot know reality. It cannot grasp the good. It does not move man. Man, said the new vision, is guilty, disoriented, futile. He's a being frozen by terror, a cipher, a monster, a filthy little psychopath. The appropriate response to such a being, said the vision spreaders, is pity or revulsion or an ironic yawn. This is a new culture and a new modern vision. There have been mystical cultures in the West prior to our century. In parentheses, in the non-Western world, they have dominated all history. End of parentheses. The two most enduring were those of the pre-Greek and the medieval periods. The men of these eras understood, in some terms, how to think, and as a matter of practical necessity, they did not think to some extent, but they were unable to identify the nature of the process of thought or the principles by which to guide it. The pre-Greek civilization, never discovering the field of epistemology, had no explicit idea of a cognitive process, which is systematic, secular, observation-based, logic-ruled. The medievals, for centuries, had no access to most of this knowledge. The dominant mystical ideas of such cultures represent a non-rational approach to the world, not an anti-rational approach. In essence, the spokesmen of these earlier times did not know what reason is or therefore what it makes possible in human life. The Weimar culturati knew it. So did the rest of the moderns. They knew the philosophical discoveries of ancient Greece. They have seen the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the 19th century. They know what had been possible in every field during the more rational eras of the Western past. They know what was possible to Aristotle, to Aquinas, to Michelangelo, to Galileo, to Newton, to Jefferson, to a line of thinkers and creatures, to man. The 20th century rejection of the mind is not implicit or uninformed. The eyes of the modernists are purposeful and open, wide open in a campaign to close all eyes. There is a second difference between modern culture and its mystical predecessors. In whatever terms the spokesmen of earlier eras did grasp and then reject the dictates of reason, they did it primarily as a protective measure to preserve and propagate ideas, however otherworldly, ideas which they identified reverently as truth. They sought to protect from question or attack a cosmogonic legend, a cherished theological system, a holy faith revealing to them the nature of the gods or God, of the good and the right, of man's destiny and salvation. When such cultures attacked man, it was on the grounds that he did not measure up to the perfection ascribed to a supernatural realm. Modern culture is not otherworldly. Among the Weimar intellectuals, organized religion was no longer a living power, nor do these intellectuals regard secular philosophy as any kind of power or value. The leaders and spokesmen of modern culture, German or otherwise, do not endorse any organized set of principles. They do not accept revelation or reason. Whatever their dogmatic subsects, which surface now and then, the modern intellectuals, characteristically and philosophically, are not zealots, but relativists or skeptics. They do not seek salvation, but claim there is none. Their countenance is not transfigured by an upward glance at truth. It is disfigured by a sneer proclaiming the futility of ideas. The sneer is expressed by philosophic movements which boastfully offer no message, by educators who deliberately teach no subject matter, by artists whose work eliminates recognizable context, by psychologists who hold that ideas are mere rationalizations, by novelists such as Thomas Mann, and by all the alleged valuers in all these groups, which purport to love mankind as a whole, a love whose reality may be gauged by a single fact. The same groups extol mankind while vilifying men and man. The moderns reject reason disinterestedly, with no explicit idea of anything to put in its place, no alternative means of knowledge, no formal dogma to preserve or protect, and they reject reason passionately along with every one of its cardinal products and expressions, every achievement it took human thought centuries of struggle to rise to, define, or reach. In form, the modernists' monolithic rejection consists of many mutually contradictory claims. In essence, their line has been consistent and unbreached. Man's science, they say, requires the dismissal of values, and in parentheses, Max Weber. His feelings require the dismissal of science, in parentheses, Heidegger. His society requires the dismissal of the individual, in parentheses, the Frankfurt Institute. His individuality requires liberation from logic, in parentheses, the Bauhaus. Logic is oppression. Consistency is an illusion. Causality is dated. Free will is a myth. Morality is a convention. Self-esteem is immoral. Heroism is laughable. Individual achievement is 19th century. Personal ambition is selfish. Freedom is antisocial. Business is exploitation. Wealth is swinish. Health is pedestrian. Happiness is superficial. Sexual standards are hypocrisy. Machine civilization is an obscenity. Grammar is unfair. Communication is impossible. Law and order are boring. Sanity is bourgeois. Beauty is a lie. Art is shit. You think Leonard was getting a little worked up during this section of the book? All right, Leonard. All right, truth is unknowable, the modern relativists say, and the truth, they say, is the absurdity of life, absurdity and nothingness, and crawling human lice. They say it, but they do not believe it in the way that men did once believe its equivalents. When Tertullian said that incarnation is an absurdity and therefore certain, it expressed the viewpoint of a religious fanatic who worshipped what he called absurd. The modern cult of absurdity is different. The Deists and their ilk do not worship public urinals or Hamlet slipping on soap or Beethoven symphonies played backwards. When real Oriental mystics proclaim the primacy of Nirvana, their self-flagellating, insect-revering lives are testimony to the fact that in some terms they mean it. When 20th century Western Orientalists say that all is nothingness, they say it on a full stomach. The zero they preach through the latest microphones does not disturb their routine, their footnotes, their cocktail parties, or their royalties. When the Act of Savages portrayed man as a cringing monstrosity, it was a terrified attempt to placate the jealous gods of the tribe. When modern savage emulators portray their vision of man, they do not believe the witchcraft they borrow. They do not they do it not in terror, but with a snicker, while their counterparts in the humanities expressing the same vision takes pride in being flexible. They are not disturbed if someone denies the Oedipus complex and substitutes as the key to human nature an inferiority complex or an orgasm complex or a collective unconsciousness or any equivalent, so long as it is an equivalent, which leaves a single constant untouched. What the moderns actually believe in and seek to accomplish is not the exaltation of an absurdity above the power of science, but the sabotage of science. Not the adoration of Stocknitz, but the defeat of this world. Not human abasement as a desperate plea to the gods, but human abasement for the sake of human abasement. When the leading voices of the emotionalist republic championed feeling, it was not as a source of knowledge or of human happiness, but of freedom, the freedom from objectivity, method, logic, fact. It was feeling not as an alleged means to truth, but as a nullification of thought. In a masterly essay analyzing the modern sense of life, and here we go, Ayn Rand points to the pervasive 20th century attacks on intelligence, success, achievement, beauty, and identifies the essence and the evil of the spirit they reveal. That essence, she writes, is, quote, hatred of the good for being the good, end of quote. And of course, you know that Peikoff is a devotee of Ayn Rand and her objectiveness. The modern cultural rebellion is an eloquent testament on an all-encompassing scale to the truth of her identification. Modern culture is institutionalized hatred of the good. The good in this context includes reason, reality, and man. This rebellion is not merely skepticism, which is an ancient theory denying that knowledge is a possible, or pessimism, which denies that success is possible, or cynicism, which denies that virtue is possible, or decadence, which settles wearily for festering disintegration, or even sadism, which manufactures human pain. The term that captures 20th century culture, the term that includes all of these and every similar value-annulling doctrine and attitude, the term that names the modern goal is nihilism. Nihilism in this context means hatred, the hatred of values and of their root, reason. Hatred is not the same as disapproval, contempt, or anger. Hatred is loathing combined with fear and with a desire to lash out at the hated object, to wound, to disfigure, to destroy it. The essence and impelling premise of the nihilist modern is the quest for destruction, the destruction of all values, of values as such, and of the mind. It is a destruction he seeks for the sake of destruction, not as a means, but as an end. This is what underlies, generates, and defines Weimar culture. Contrary to the cataract of rationalization spread by their apologists, the Weimar intellectuals were not moved by a feeling of rebellion against the stifling conformity of the German bourgeois or the Prussian mindlessness of the imperial establishment. Men do not rebel against mindlessness by urging the abandonment of the mind, and they do not rebel against a specific social class by lashing out at man as such. The roots of Weimar culture do not lie in the disgust of the younger intellectuals at the senseless slaughter of World War I, or the frenzied insanity of the German inflation, or any similar practical horror. Men do not fight against senselessness by demanding more of it, or against horror by wallowing in it, or against rot by glorifying disease, or against insanity by enshrining lunatics. The actuating impulse of the Weimar moderns was not passion for innovation. Innovation does not consist in reversion to the pre-scientific era, or in the movements urging back to Kant, or back to Luther, or back to astrology, Bushman paintings, and jungle dance rituals. The Weimar moderns were alienated, as they said, but the cause was not anything so superficial as social institutions or political systems. Their alienation existed on the most profound level men can experience. They were alienated from the basic values human life requires, from the human means of knowledge, from man's essential relation to reality. A mass revolt against a specific set of fundamental ideas can be explained only by an acceptance of opposite ideas. The late 19th century German intellectuals absorbed what all their deepest thinkers had taught them. They caught the essence of the message. The message being, reality is out. Reason is out. The pursuit of values is out. Man is out. And then they looked at the world around them, the Western world still shaped by the premises of the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment. The intellectuals saw pyramiding scientific and technological discoveries. They saw value-glorifying art animated by an inspired vision of man. They saw purposeful innovators in every field creating unprecedented achievements, men who did not find reason impotent, but but who were smilingly confident of their power to achieve their goals. They saw the bourgeoisie, and the workers in every social class, excepting only themselves and the remnants of the feudal aristocracy, reveling in the luxuries of an industrial civilization, producing goods and happiness, seeking more of both, refusing to sacrifice the treasures which, for the first time in history, masses of men were able to acquire. The intellectuals saw it, and they knew they had to choose. They had to challenge the anti-mind doctrines they had been taught, or the minds of those who had not yet been indoctrinated. Their alternative was to demolish the view of life bred into their feelings, or the glowing aftermath of the world of the Enlightenment, a world which was, to them, an alien planet and a reproach. They chose according to their fundamentals and their guilt. They became nihilists. Such men cannot create an authentically innovative culture, not while believing that reality is unknowable and that man is helpless. All they could do, aside from resurrecting the irrationalism of the past, was to find their creative outlet in destroying what they saw around them. Their goal and product was a cultural wasteland reflecting the kinds of ideas they felt they could live with. In the case of the leaders of the modern rebellion, many ugly psychological factors were undoubtedly at work, such as self-loathing and resentment of the success of others, and the lust to be of significance by destroying what one cannot equal. By themselves, however, motives as vicious as these are impotent. They pertain in any age only to a handful of men and do not explain the world influence of any trend, including the modernist one. The thing that makes the difference between evil private psychology and powerful public movement is ideas, fundamental ideas, and the science that deals with them. It is philosophy, a certain kind of philosophy, established on the world scene by means of formal, detailed, multi-volumed, universally respected statement, which left uncertain kinds of men with certain kinds of psychological motives free to bear their souls publicly, and which wiped out the possibility of any effective resistance to these men and motives, first in Germany, the cultural pacesetter, then everywhere else. Just as a few men with Hitler's kind of hatred for the Jews have existed for many centuries, but remained impotent publicly until they heard, voiced on a world scale, the philosophical premises they needed to implement their hatred, just as these men were then free to rationalize their feeling as a crusade for purity or Lebensraum, to disarm an entire nation and to gain mass converts to the cause of mass slaughter, so a few men with the modern intellectuals' hatred for values as such have always existed, but remained impotent publicly until they heard the premises they needed. The premises freed them to disarm men on an international scale, to rationalize their hatred as modern culture, and to unleash on a cowed, bewildered public a crew of noisy activist innovators dedicated to the cause of mass destruction. The basic liberator, in both cases, was Kant's philosophy. No earlier system could have done it. Kant denies this world, not in the name of a glowing super-reality, but in effect of nothing, of a realm which is, by his own statement, unknowable to man and inconceivable. He rejects the human mind because of its very nature, while using the same kind of argument against every other possible form of cognition. He regards men, all men, as devoid of worth because they seek values, in any realm. Kant is the first major philosopher to turn against reality, reason, values, and man as such, not in the name of something allegedly higher, but in the name of pure destruction. He is not an otherworldly thinker, but an anti-worldly one. He is the father of nihilism. The modern politicians of the Weimar Republic, anxious to combat the irrationalism of the entrenched professorate, created a new university at Hamburg, then elevated to the chair of philosophy Ernest Cassirer, one of the country's top neo-Kantians. This indicates what Germany's leaders grasped about the cause of their plight or about the effects of ideas. The German intellectuals translated Kant's system into cultural terms in the only way it could be done. They created a culture in which the new consists of negation and obliteration. Thus, the new novels, whose newness consists in having no plots and no heroes, novels featuring characters without characterization and written in language without syntax, using words without reference, and thus the poems free of rhyme, the verse free of meter, the plays without action, theater without the theatrical illusion, education without cognition, physics without law, mathematics without consistency, art without beauty, atonal music, non-objective painting, unconscious psychology, philosophy without metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, politics, or thought. And thus, too, the conservative intellectuals of Weimar Germany, who hated the modernist hatred and supplied their own brand. The tone setters among the conservatives were not nostalgia craving Deadwood. Sorry, it just tickled me. Yearning to go back only a few decades or so, they were a new breed, relatively young, highly educated, and more ambitious than that. Such men knew what they thought of thought and of its products. They knew the practical meaning of their crusade against bourgeois materialism. They knew what the age of pre-industry and pre-science had been, and that it could be again. Thus Spengler, like Sombart, quote, repudiates even technological progress and labor-saving devices. The fact that they have saved hand labor and drudgery and open up the possibility of a good life for the workers is reason enough for condemning them. Work and hardship are good in themselves, and general education and progress illusory. And as I rumble around, I have to give you attribution on that quote, which they don't have in footnotes, but in endnotes. And that quote came from V.J. McGill in an article, Notes on Philosophy in Nazi Germany, Science and Society, a Marxian Quarterly, Volume 4, Number 1, Winter, 1940, page 27. Want to know anything else? And so we go on. And thus, in another variant, Ernst Jünger, the fiery conservative youth leader who hurled anathemas at the bourgeoisie, demanded heroic activism and urged violence, revolution, bloody war, not, he told his eager following, for the sake of ideas or purposes of any kind, but for the sake of violence, revolution, and bloody war. I think Picot's being funny there, don't you? If conservatism means the desire to preserve the traditional forms of a culture, the key to such intellectual lies in the fact that they were modern conservatives, that is, conservative nihilists, who sought to preserve in order to destroy. What they sought to preserve were the most irrational features, social and intellectual, of the German past. What they sought to destroy were any rational Western imports. The left moderns claimed to like the West, but hated its distinctive 19th century culture. The right moderns liked the 19th century, unmechanized 19th century Prussia, and hated the West. The result was, in effect, a division of labor. The left moderns concentrated on the intellectual attainments of the past, on the destruction of art, education, science, in parentheses, while, sometimes, wishing to retain technology, end of parentheses. The right moderns, taking German irrationalism for granted, concentrated on the material attainments, on the destruction of the machine age and of industrial civilization. Such was the kind of choice offered to Germany by its intellectual leaders. The hatred of every human value in the name of avant-garde novelty or in the name of feudal reaction. The rejection of nature by the Oriental method or by the medieval method. The denunciation of the mind as an obstacle to self-expression or to social obedience. Man as a primordial, Freudian brute versus man as a primordial, Wagnerian brute, sorry, no W there. Ideas as feudal versus the intellect as arid. Life as horror versus life as war. Cynical pessimism on one side versus cynical pessimism on the other side. The open nihilism of Brecht or of Ernst Jünger. In the orgy which was the cultural atmosphere of the Weimar Republic, the Germans could not work to resolve their differences. Disintegrated by factionalism, traumatized by crisis, and pumped full of the defiant rejection of reason in every form and from all sides, the Germans felt not calm, but hysteria. Not confidence in regard to others, but the inability to communicate with them. Not hope, but despair. Not the desire for solutions to their problems, but the need for scapegoats. And as a result, not goodwill, but fury, blind fury at their enemies, real or imagined. Nihilism in Germany worked to exacerbate economic and political resentments by undermining the only weapon that could have dealt with them. The intellectuals wanted to destroy values. The public, shaped by this trend, ended up wanting to destroy men. The social corollary of Weimar culture was a country animated and torn apart by hatred, seething in groups trained to be impervious to reason. Doesn't that sound like all the partisan supporters of Republicans and Democrats? The political corollary was the same country put back together by Hitler. For years, the Weimar culturati, left and right, dismissed Hitler as a crank who was not to be taken seriously. The leftist intellectuals regarded Nazism as a movement devoid of ideas. Hitler, they said, is merely a vulgar rowdy or a lackey of big business. The rightist intellectuals, as a rule cultured men who were not racists, listened uneasily to Hitler's gutter denunciations of their own favorite targets, such as communism and cultural Bolshevism. The Nazis, they said, are rabble who are debasing the idea of a reborn Germany. Both these groups found 1933 inexplicable. How, they wondered, as they stumbled dazedly out of the country or into the concentration camps, could a band of near illiterates have been able to achieve respectability and power on a nationwide scale? To an extent, the role of the conservative intellectuals in this regard has been recognized. In parentheses, their political ideas are so close to those of the Nazis that it is difficult for anyone to miss the connection. End of parentheses. The role of Weimar culture, however, has not been identified. Did Freud say, pessimistically, that man is ruled by violent instincts, which no rational political arrangements can alter, and that social equilibrium depends on each individual repressing his deepest desires? The Germans heard Hitler say it, too, euphorically. And they heard that, in regard to enforcing such repression, there is an agent more potent than the superego, the SA. Did the progressive German hear the existentialist say that one must think with one's will? Did he hear the new theologian say that the self-sufficiency of reason is the fundamental sin? He heard the Nazis promise the triumph of the will and an end to the age of reason. Did the concerned citizen hear Hauptmann and Rathenau denounce the evils of machine civilization? Did he hear Max Weber deplore the loss of magic inherent in secular industrial society? He heard the Nazis demand a return to the purity of rural communes and to the magic of blood and soil. Did the parent hear the new educator say that everything is relative and that the feeling of fantasizing supersedes thought? Isn't that John Dewey for you? You bet. He heard the Nazis say that there is no truth but myth and no absolute but the Führer. Did the art lover hear all the Kandinskys and Klees curse objectivity and insist that the art's inspiration is not logic but the mythological and the occult? It is our inspiration too, it said the Nazi leaders, and they worked to resurrect Wotan and consulted their astrologers for practical guidance. Did the theater goer discover that communication requires delirious raving in liberated language? Listen to Hitler, said the Nazis. Is it good to wipe out the bourgeois world, as the expressionist said? It is precisely at the task of wiping out that the Nazis promised to be efficient. Is it daring to turn life into madness, as the Dadaists said? They were village jokers compared to the Nazis. Is it profound to keep faith with death in one's heart, as Thomas Mann said? It is a faith the Nazis knew how to keep. The left moderns miscalculated. If nihilism was the standard as they made it, then Nazism was unbeatable because Nazism is the final extreme of nihilism in a form that was tailored to attract all the major groups in Germany. Hitler denounced some avant-garde details. He raved against cultural Bolshevism. But as he did with Marxism, he unfailingly preached its essence. He stripped from the intellectuals only in one tactical respect. He stripped the modernist ideas of their world-weary pessimism and made nihilism the basis of a fantasy projection, promising a new order in which men would rise to unprecedented heights by means of illogic, self-immolation, worldwide destruction, and strict obedience to the Führer. The intellectuals were spreading the doctrines which, directly or indirectly, produce helplessness, demoralization, despair on a mass scale. Once it was done, it was easy for the right kind of killer to kick the spreaders aside. He had only to announce that he was not helpless and would tell men what to do. In later years, the creators of Weimar culture, the ones who survive, cursed the German people for not having listened to them. The tragedy is the people had listened. All right, that's the end of this section. This segment is number 10 and the end of chapter 10 as well. Like I said, we're pretty close to the end here, but I mean, please consider this stuff in light of what's happening here and what is going to happen. Thanks for being with us. Hope you're here next time.